Anytime a giant lizard invades your city, you've got an emergency on your hands. And that means it's time for an emergency podcast. Welcome to Historians of the Movies podcast. I'm your host and creator, Jason Herbert. And every single week, we're bringing for you talks about movies and history and movies and everything else in between. And tonight, we're talking to you. We're creating a special podcast as fast as we possibly could, talking about writer-director Takashi Yamazaki's Godzilla Minus One. And guys, I wanted to bring in to you and talk to you about this film, and I brought for you two amazing scholars. I'm talking about Bill Tsutsui's work, who is probably the single foremost expert of Godzilla in the entire world, and also Akiko Takenaka, and she is a professor of social and cultural history of modern Japan at the University of Kentucky. And we have the most amazing conversation ahead for you. I just recorded this conversation about 5 minutes ago. We're about to get it up here on the pod just in a second. The pod is lined up for you in two different ways. This movie's still in theaters right now. So the first portion of this pod is a spoiler-free discussion about Godzilla, the history of Godzilla, the history of Japanese cinema, where Japan is following World War II. To kind of get you up to speed. So if you're not familiar with Godzilla Minus One, you're not familiar with Godzilla, you can listen in, kind of get everything you need to know right in the headway. And then we're going to dive into the movie itself, give our hot takes on this movie, talk about maybe the crisis of manhood in post-war Japan, what it means to survive the war, to come together, ideas how Japanese people are reflecting on the war through this film. Guys, this is such an amazing discussion. I learned so freaking much. I hope you're going to dig this. We're going to get this out to you as fast as we possibly can. So guys, sit back and relax, because Godzilla Minus One is next on Historians of the Movies podcast. Akiko, how are you guys tonight?
Doing great, thank you.
Okay, I was just saying before we started, this is my first time ever talking to you guys. I've been talking to you for 2 days in the history of my life now. So thank you so much for being here tonight and being part of this amazing thing, this Godzilla Minus One, which is just, it's insane. I typically don't do like rush off to the movies, but the hoopla and the excitement behind this film are just incredible right now. And I was so excited to bring this and talk about it. It's like, and Bill, you and I were just talking before we started rolling here. It's like, this is really the first Japanese version of this to really hit like it has here in the States.
As a lifelong Godzilla fan, this is one of the great moments of my life, I will say, to see a Japanese Godzilla movie be successful at the American box office.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. All right, cool. It feels like it's time, right? And maybe that says a lot about the movies. Maybe it says a lot about, you know, this is a low budget film by a lot of comparisons and stuff like that. Doesn't feel that way, but you know, we can jump into that too if you guys want and so forth. But before we get into that, maybe we could introduce you guys and say who you are, a little bit about who you are and why we're here, and go from there. How's that? Bill,
sounds
you want to go? Bill, you want to go first? Sorry.
Sure. I'm Bill Tsutsui. I am right now Chancellor of Ottawa University in Kansas. I am also a historian of modern Japan. My boring specialty is business and economic history, but what I really love working on is my childhood love of Godzilla. I wrote a book in 2004 for the 50th anniversary called Godzilla on My Mind, I've done a few things since then, and am that model ACA-fan, so both scholarly and an aficionado.
Okay, hi, I'm Akiko Takenaka. I'm Associate Professor of History at the University of Kentucky. I teach modern Japan and Asian American history. I was living underneath a rock the last few months because things were very busy. I'm finishing the manuscript for my second book. And so I did not know about this film. I'm going to be completely honest. I did not know about the existence of this film until Wednesday night. When I got on Twitter, I refused to call it X. I got on Twitter and then I saw a notification and I saw that you know, a former graduate student in my department, Corinne Gursang, she had tagged me, and I was like, what is going on here? And then I realized there's a new film. And then I was like, oh, cool. I know the absolute authority on this topic. I'm just going to, you know, introduce Bill to Jason, and somehow I ended up being on here. I have watched the first Godzilla from 1954. I have watched the American remake of that film, right? And so I've taught it a couple times, but I do work on issues that has to do with war and memory in Japan. And in fact, my first book was on Yasukuni Shrine, which is this very controversial war memorial in Tokyo. And so I think I can maybe say a couple things from that angle.
Well, that actually, you know, that's absolutely perfect. And firstly, that's kind of the fun part, the good part of like what Twitter does is that because it can be a real mess, right? Social, I think we've all lamented what so much social media has become. But in its best, it can unite people, right? And we're all here talking together. Three of us are talking. Really, the first time the three of us are talking together because of that, because of film, because we all like movies, we like history, and so forth. And Akiko, I didn't tell you I'm from Kentucky, so
I saw that you're a Kentucky colonel.
Yes, that's right.
How did you become a colonel?
So I'm from Murray, out in the western part of the state. I am a diehard Kentucky basketball fan, like many Kentuckians are. And a friend of mine had, as I was going through writing my dissertation and doing all this stuff, probably embellished way too much to talk, but they had kind of written to the governor, to whomever it was that gets the colonelship, and said, you know, I do good things about Kentucky. I don't know. I have it framed, you know, I got the Kentucky colonel thing. So now I'm a son of the Bluegrass.
Colonel. Yes.
Hello,
I'm
fellow
a colonel,
colonel
too.
And Bill, I lived in Kansas for 5 years.
Really?
I went to Wichita
Where
State. Wichita.
Wow.
So my younger boy was actually born there. So we have connections.
Fantastic
here,
small
here
world.
As well.
Yeah,
I know. Right. So now you guys have to come to Colorado. Sorry, but that's the rules. So
that sounds very cool.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, let's start with some basic stuff. And, you know, I think in a lot of ways you guys are so perfect for this. And Bill, you know, you're the mega fan of Godzilla. Akiko, you're talking about memory and culture. And I think that so much of what Godzilla speaks to is how, you know, people in Japan are grappling with the war. And as Godzilla becomes this global thing, I think it opens up these larger conversations that we can have too. So I'm hoping we can kind of talk about that. Because for me, watching this film was like, I had never really seen Japanese cinema wrestling with the war, at least not recently. I don't get to watch a lot of Japanese cinema. So that's one of the magical things I think about this film is like people are going and getting to see Japanese productions right now. And this is really, really cool. Let's start with the basics. I thought maybe what we would do with this emergency podcast would be to introduce who Godzilla is as a character and also maybe where the creation of Godzilla comes from, you know, the ethos behind the fictional creation of Godzilla. And then maybe, you know, so people that want to go see the film can kind of get a background on Godzilla itself. And then we can kind of jump into the film. So if people want to listen to part of this and then go see the film or whatever, we don't spoil it, but we can spoil the rest of it as we go along, if that makes any sense. So maybe we can start with the basic idea. Who's Godzilla? And from as a creature standpoint, and then also where does it come from a sheer work of fantasy?
Well, Godzilla is the giant monster of the atomic age. You know, in many ways, Godzilla is created from the atom bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and from the Cold War in the 1950s. So Godzilla, the first movies in 1954, has a direct inspiration in the re-release of King Kong, the 1933 Hollywood classic, in 1952 worldwide. Japanese filmmakers get this idea of making a giant monster movie of their own, but they refract it through the lens of where Japan is at that time. And that is to say, it is recovering from World War II, it is recovering from the atomic bombings, and it's caught in the middle of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union as a very weak, vulnerable, and at that point, poor place. And so Godzilla, in many ways, is a manifestation of the anxieties of the Japanese people in the first days of the Cold War.
Yeah, I felt like, I don't think it spoils anything getting into this particular film, but like, boy, was that really you know, apparent as I was watching Godzilla Minus One. I had never really seen it spelled out before, especially as I watched the American versions of Godzilla. This is a different version of Godzilla. And I'd kind of read elsewhere that Godzilla is really, in the Japanese mind, is more half monster, half god. Is that where what is Godzilla as far as how do we – is he a dinosaur? Is he an iguana? Is he reviewer number two? What what is Godzilla?
You know, Godzilla, you know, if we look at the origin story, Godzilla is this survivor from the Jurassic Age that happens to be swimming around in the ocean south of Japan. But then through U.S. H-bomb testing on Bikini Atoll in 1954 in the Castle Bravo test, Godzilla is irradiated. And in fact, of course, a Japanese fishing boat had been irradiated by that test in that year. It made huge headlines because the sailors, needless to say, suffered from radiation poisoning. One subsequently died. And as was the practice at the time, the American government denied everything. Food poisoning, they said. Not a big deal. And so in the Japanese media, this, of course, was front page news, and it was described as the latest atomic bombing of Japan.
And I can add a little bit to that, too, because, you know, they were fishing tuna, and they were right outside of, you know, so the United States had declared a zone. It was a rectangle, but, you know, radiation isn't all that compact.
Not so much.
So they were like right outside the zone, but of course they get irradiated, right? But they had already caught a whole bunch of tuna. And so they go back home with the tuna, and by the time the news breaks, the tuna is already at the Tsukiji market in Tokyo. And so this nationwide panic ensues, right? And so, you know, we have like officials at the markets with Geiger counters, and they end up burying all of the radiated tuna. But, you know, it continues because the United States is continuing the experiments, which means that everyone's afraid to eat fish, which is a major source of protein. And they start measuring radiation in rainwater and in vegetables. And so it becomes this like nationwide panic. And like Bill said, right, this is the third time that we have been impacted by, a version of atomic bomb. And that's March 1954. And Bill, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it like September 1954 that the original Godzilla movie comes out? And
November, beginning of November.
November. But still, that's so fast, right? 8 months.
And I just got to add my tourism note here. The fishing boat that was irradiated has been preserved by the municipality of Tokyo. You can visit it now as a museum. And one of the most charming things about the museum, and there isn't a whole lot charming about an irradiated fishing boat, but the charming thing is there is a monument in the garden outside to the tuna that were sacrificed and not consumed, and therefore were victims of this event.
Plus the land that museum is built on is what do you call it?
Landfill.
Landfill.
Yeah.
Of garbage, and it is called the Dream Island. That is the name of the island on which the museum has been built.
Was Godzilla an initial hit in Japan? When it's released, I mean, what were the initial responses to this film, both in Japan and then maybe globally? How did that happen?
So Godzilla did do well at the box office when it opened in 1954. It set a new record for weekend box office for a domestic film in Tokyo, and was such a success that Toho Studios, which is the movie studio that made it, decided immediately to try and find international distributors for it. At that time, it was mainly Japanese art house films that were going into international distribution. So nobody quite knew how a giant monster movie was going to fare globally, but a distributor bought it in Hollywood and was instantly faced with a quandary. Do we make this a art house film with subtitles, or do we dub it so that the kids who we think naturally will want to watch it find it accessible? And what they did was they split the difference. They really cleverly re-edited it to avoid subtitling it. They added Raymond Burr as an American journalist in Tokyo watching the ravages of the monster. But in the process, they lost 20 minutes of the original. It got left on the cutting room floor. And that has subsequently been called whitewashing censorship because they happened to take out the sections that were most implicitly critical of nuclear testing and thus by extension America. So really it was rendered more palatable for what distributors thought were very sensitive American audiences in the mid-1950s.
I'm kind of wondering if when this film comes out, say, 54, is Japanese cinema dealing with World War II in cinema at this point in time? Is there a reflection of the war at this point in time? Do we see this like we see in the United States? What's going on in Japanese movie theaters as well?
Bill and I are looking at each other.
Yeah, Akiko, do you want to take it? Do you want me to take it?
I only know a little bit. I do know that some related films came out right after the occupation, right? Like books or collections of children's essays about their experiences. They started to come out right when the occupation ended, and some of them had been taken up and cinematized. Sort of like, you know, children's experiences and their struggles during the war and air raids and atomic bombs and things like that.
So what's the interesting background to this, I think, is that immediately after the atomic bombings, so when the U.S. occupiers first arrived in Japan, they wanted the Japanese to know about the power of the atom bombs. So they made sure that information got out. They brought back a lot of Japanese soldiers who were overseas through Hiroshima so they could see the destruction and have America's power underlined to them. But they realized pretty quickly that there could be backlash from the Japanese at the atomic bombings. And so MacArthur and his forces decided to clamp down on information about the bombs. And so actually censorship of public media conversations about the bombings was pretty tightly regulated from 1946 until 1952. And so it had only been for a couple of years before Godzilla came out that Japanese could really speak in public about the atomic bombings. Even at that point, because the atomic bombs were such a traumatizing event, they were largely taboo in Japan's polite society. And so people didn't talk about them a lot. Some movies did deal with them, some of them in quite, you know, funny tongue-in-cheek ways. There is one movie where there's a character who is a sort of a comic character who blames all of her problems on the atomic bombs. That, you know, she didn't win the lottery because of the atomic bombs. You know, her candidate in election didn't get elected because of the atomic bombs and so forth. But really, Godzilla is one of the very first movies to deal with that deep trauma that people felt about the bombs and defeat.
Yeah, this is a fascinating thing. Was I've started to, you know, more critically look at film. I grew up, you know, I was born in 77, so I kind of grew up, you know, knowing about Godzilla. Godzilla is to me in my childhood in the 1980s. I would see comic books a lot. There weren't a lot of American Godzilla films at that point in time. We kind of went through this vacuum of time, and then starts to see this reemergence, I guess, late 90s with, was it the Roland Emmerich film that came out? I remember the trailer that comes out with the giraffe. You've got the Tyrannosaurus Rex, and then you've got the foot coming down on top of it. But I read today that there are more Godzilla films than James Bond films. Is this correct? It's like it is a massive, not just in the United States, but Japan.
There are 30 Godzilla live-action films made since 1954. Three full-length animated features, and four, soon to be five, American Godzilla films. And then, of course, there are, you know, many, many knockoffs in Japan and around the world that were inspired by Godzilla, but because Godzilla was under copyright, could not be Godzilla, from Gamera to Yongari in Korea to Gorgo in Britain.
You don't get Pacific Rim without Godzilla.
You know, exactly. You know? The fact that Pacific Rim is called kaiju, which is the Japanese word for giant monsters, shows, you know, the globalization of that term is really fascinating. There are not a lot of film genres come from foreign languages, frankly, and certainly not from Asian languages. So the fact that, you know, the Japanese film genres that have had an impact globally, kaiju is at the lead, pretty amazing.
All right. Well, we've brought us all the way up now to December 9th, 2023. If you are listening to the pod right now, you've got a little bit of background about how we get to where we are now. So if you haven't seen the film, you don't want to spoil the film, just pause. If you want to keep going, you want to wreck the city of this podcast, go for it. Because I think now let's just jump into the film itself, and we're just going to spoil it from here on out and talk freely about the film. So I guess let's start there. All three of us have seen the movie now. Bill, you said you've seen it multiple times now. What are your thoughts on the movie? First, what are your first hot takes on this movie?
I would say, wow, you know, this movie has something for everyone. You know, it has the special effects and the action that a lot of people expect from a Godzilla movie. But the big surprise for me, it has a great human drama in it as well. What's also neat, though, is it has political and historical messages that are substantive and worth talking about. So for me, it's the whole package.
Yeah, it was great entertainment. And I'm sure I was laughing at parts where I shouldn't be laughing, but I had a blast watching it. It also reminded me of, you know, the ways that Japanese people are still grappling with their wartime past, right? How many years has it been? It's almost like the 80th anniversary, right? 2025 is going to be the 80th anniversary, which means that most people who were alive in 1945 are, you know, becoming fewer and fewer, and yet they have inherited this memory and this trauma. And I almost saw it as this like redemptive, or almost like an acting out, right? It's sort of like, we are going to do this all right, and we can talk about the details later, but it was also almost like, okay, we failed in so many aspects, and we blame, right, like the government and the military and whatnot, but this time around, we are going to get it right, was sort of the underlying message, I felt like.
I think this movie is brilliant on so many levels. And as I watched it last night, it was sitting in, and then I went to, you know, I came home, thought about it, and all day long, all I could do was think about this movie. And here was the big thought I had with this, and this is where I think this movie is brilliant. This is a Godzilla movie that is not about Godzilla. You know, this movie is about a man and his redemptive quest. This is a movie about a people who are trying to understand where they are in the world and try to, you know, in some ways kind of reassert their own place. You know, this idea of like the community is going to take care of this. The government has failed us. The United States can't help out on this. We're caught between the United States and the Soviet Union in this Cold War. They say it specifically, which I was like, this movie has got so much to say about history in the past. And yeah, like you're saying, still dealing with the ramifications of World War II and the bombs specifically some 80 years later. This is also, Bill, is this also the first period piece Godzilla film that we've seen?
You know, there are flashback scenes in some of the later Godzilla movies. So there's one Godzilla movie called Godzilla versus King Ghidorah from the 1990s that flashes back to World War II and a dinosaur that becomes Godzilla during World War II. But this is the first one that is actively not set in, you know, the contemporary period.
I kept thinking as I was watching, it's like, oh, okay, it's 45. Oh, it's 47. Okay, when are we going to get to the present? At first, I was like, oh, it's going to be about their grandkids. and then, oh, we're staying here now. Okay, cool. Well, this makes it, you know, a completely different film. So there were a lot of – I felt like there were a lot of throwbacks to – can we talk about what we see as Godzilla himself, like the design of Godzilla? Is this in line? Is there a general consensus as far as like what Godzilla should look like? What are the thoughts on that?
You know, I will honestly say in my lifetime, I don't think I've ever been around for the launch of a new Godzilla movie where there has been less discussion of the design of the monster among the fan community, because people were so taken by the human storyline that the monster faded into the background. And what you said, Jason, the monster isn't that important in some ways in that movie. This movie is true, right? Because there is so much to hang your hat on, you don't have to go straight into the weeds of, you know, well, you know, how many toes does Godzilla have? And, you know, what is it like when he shoots his heat ray and so forth? This Godzilla, I think, is not terribly revolutionary in its design. It does draw a little bit more on maybe a Jurassic Park Godzilla because of its origins, which we see here, and its powerful legs. And the texture of its skin is a little bit different from previous Godzillas. But this is very much in keeping with where Godzilla has been in the past.
So I've only watched the first one, but I kind of felt like the head was much smaller than I remembered.
You know, and you're right.
Spoiler alert is okay, right?
Yeah. You know,
oh, yeah, spoil away, absolutely. Yeah, go for it.
So I kept worrying at the very end, right? When what was his name? Skisma?
Yeah.
When he's flying his plane and planning to fly into Godzilla's mouth. And I was like, that's not going to fit. The mouth is too small. I had the weirdest worry while I was watching
that. That shows you really got into the movie that you were thinking about that, though.
You know what? But the plane doesn't fit in Godzilla's mouth at the end. He just kind of smashes into it. Into his mouth.
He kind of chomped on it, right? Yeah.
Well, hasn't that always been a bit of a critique of the Godzilla design, is that the head's always felt a bit small compared to the rest of the body? I mean, I seem to remember this in the most recent films. Am I wrong?
You know, actually, it became a critique in the 60s and 70s when Godzilla became more Muppet-like, as I've described him, when the movies were geared more at children, that the head got bigger, you know? And so I think that in response to that, movie makers, to make a more threatening Godzilla, and definitely this is supposed to be a threatening Godzilla, right? Mm-hmm. This is a mean Godzilla. You know, the scenes at the beginning, which, you know, those opening scenes are pretty fabulous, I think.
Oh, my goodness.
It's not often you get a Godzilla movie where you see the monster straight off. And in this case, see the monster bite someone in half and fling him in the air. You know, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, there were a couple of thoughts there. I think that, you know, the director, is it Takashi Yamazaki? Am I saying that correctly?
Yep.
He has clearly studied his film history, right? Because there are clearly some odes to Jaws in this film. Yep. You know, first time I saw the boat, the wooden boat they get in, I was like, oh, we're going to need a bigger boat. I'm surprised they didn't even say it directly. and then the whole idea of like shooting the mine in Godzilla's mouth, I'm like, this is clearly out of Jaws as well, right? But you know, that first time when we see Godzilla on Odo Island, is that correct?
Yep.
The first time we see him, you know what I was remembered? Where I kept thinking about the time we see the T-Rex in Jurassic Park for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it felt that way to me.
Yep.
And the design feels like the old man in the rubber suit to me. That's, you were talking about the texture, Bill.
Yeah.
I kind of felt like that, you know? I mean, that was really, I mean, there was some really cool stuff to go going on, because when he does the heat ray thing, I lost my mind.
I actually think Yamazaki was very brave that the monster in that opening scene, which is the pre-radiation monster, right?
Right.
So it's the smaller, even less threatening Godzilla, that he does look so much like a Jurassic Park T-Rex, and actually so much like the 1998 Roland Emmerich TriStar Godzilla, which most Godzilla fans are very dismissive of. So the fact that he begins with that look really was, you know, he's got some guts to do that, because you could lose some fans right off. But I suspect that seeing the special effects and seeing the way the movie developed, nobody was worried too much about that.
I have a question for both of you. We keep using a certain word to refer to Godzilla. We keep saying he. And I'm kind of wondering about the gendering of Godzilla himself. My understanding is initially the people were, and I see, it seemed to have written in the movie, they kind of used the word it in the film a lot of times, and there's this non-gendering. Can we speak to like the importance of either making Godzilla non-gender specific or Godzilla male? Like, what's going on with a male Godzilla that maybe a female Godzilla doesn't allow us to have? Is there an importance to having a male Godzilla?
How much time have we got, Jason, for this one?
Well, you know, no one talks about pronouns anymore, so I thought maybe we would.
I'll tell you, I did an interview with somebody for a blog a couple of years ago, and I said, you know, we got to consider that Godzilla is non-binary, and the person said, I don't want to go there. Let's go back to whether it's a he or an it. In my book, what I say is, you know, I couldn't sex a lizard if my life depended on it. So I have no idea looking at Godzilla. As I said, he's like Ken down there. He's all smooth, you know? So I don't know if technically Godzilla is he, she, or whatever. But one thing that's influenced a lot of fans, I think, is the American Godzilla, the 1998 TriStar Godzilla, is very much a she. That monster lays eggs in Madison Square Garden. And so to differentiate the Japanese Godzilla from that American Godzilla, I think it just underlined to a lot of fans, Godzilla is a he, even though we have no basis for saying that whatsoever.
And also feel like 1954 Japanese society, right? Every big, important thing, being, needed to be a male. You know, back in the 50s, I mean, maybe some would say even today, but, you know, in the 50s, patriarchal society, and therefore everything is male-centered. And I think there was just this assumption that it's a he. And no one questioned it, I think. At least at that time, no one questioned it.
And just to be clear, you know, Japanese language does not have gender, you know? So, you know, there are no hints for us there.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if maybe it was just because Godzilla is kind of created in the – you mentioned this earlier, Bill, kind of created as a response to King Kong or something like that. Therefore, Kong has always been a male. Therefore, Godzilla would also – and, of course, now we live in a King Kong Godzilla world, which we'll get into in a bit, I'm sure. So
yeah, there is never a Godzilla lusting after Fay Wray moment, you know? So we
yet.
Can't judge from that.
Just give it time, man. I'm sure we'll get Jessica Chastain up there. Yes, you know, it'll be fine.
There's only been one kiss in the whole Godzilla series in Japan. It is an extremely G-rated series in general. There are lots of wrestling monsters. There's occasional bloodshed. But really, you know, no swearing. The worst word they say is the Japanese equivalent of darn, you know. And there's one kiss in the whole series.
So you said that my immediate thought was, did Godzilla and Mothra have a thing? What's what does that even look like on screen?
If they did, it would be outlawed in the South. That's all I can say.
Yeah, well, that's something to haunt your dreams tonight. So, you know, if anything comes out of this conversation, now that's in your head. Can we talk about the love story in this movie? Because, again, people coming to listen, it's like, wait, is this a kissing movie? You know, there's no kissing in this film either.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. The love story, I felt, was beautiful. And I did not see it coming at all.
I'm going to say, when I first learned about doing this, my first thing was, I want to hear Akiko talk about gender in Godzilla Minus One, because this is a huge, huge theme.
Now's your chance.
I mean, well, first, like the family structure, it's all surrogates, right? And it almost feels like we're going to get it right this time around. That theme is mm-hmm. is throughout. And can I also add that I did not enjoy the baby having the same name as I do.
Notice that, and then, like, notice, you know, that when I watched last night.
The baby's crying, and the adults are like trying to comfort the baby. And I'm like, no, that's not me. It's weird. The character is different, but nonetheless, you know, it is this like maternal trope, right? The woman plays this comforting role no matter what. And there were two scenes where, you know, there's no kissing, but the woman, Nobuko, I think her name was, mm-hmm. is sort of like soothing Tsukishima almost, right? Trying to soothe his trauma away. And it's sort of like, rather than hugging, she is holding his head mm-hmm. and kind of like, almost like a mother, right? Sort of like patting on the head and trying to soothe a troubled child. And so there was this like wishful thinking maternal figure that many men may or may not, I might get in trouble for saying this, but so the dynamic was very interesting. In a sense that, like, she is there as, I mean, she is saved at the very beginning, but she becomes this maternal figure that is going to be caring for this traumatized person.
I mean, this is one of the things that has disappointed me the most in reading the reviews of Godzilla Minus One, because to me, you know, after I watched the movie, of course, there are a million things that pop in my head, but one of the first ones was that this movie really is about the crisis of manhood in post-war Japan, that, you know, as is so many of the cases, after a defeat in war, the men in the society have a crisis of confidence because they have proven to be lacking. And so it is interesting to me, this fact that this, you know, family that sort of stitched together out of necessity in the ruins of war, and clearly the relationship of affection between Noriko and Tsukishima is not consummated. They never get married because for him, as he says, you know, the war isn't over yet, you know? So he's not really fully a man. And it's only really when he's redeemed and Godzilla has been defeated that they can really embrace, and one presumes as soon as they get out of the hospital, get married and form a real family instead of this sort of fictive one.
I think that's one of the real brilliances of this film is that you've got, you know, a 100-foot tall monster that breeds nuclear fire, and this is an inward looking film.
Yeah.
So much of this film, you know, I kept thinking about this, and Bill, you said this way better than I could. When I was watching last night, I was like, oh my God, this movie's about survivor's remorse. There's all this guilt about surviving. Uh-huh. You know, he's clearly, you know, as you know, and we see this very early on where he's, you know, first time we see him, he's landing his kamikaze plane, which should not land. It should crash into something. And then he's dealing with this whole, he's like, well, we were going to lose anyway. And I'm kind of wondering, is that evident in Japanese cinema? Was this a thought at the time, immediately after the war? Was like, how, you know, and I know the United States, you know, dealt with this too. Say coming out of like Vietnam, where it's like, how do we reckon with this? And we'd see this in film for the next 25 years. So I'm kind of wondering, you know, was this idea of like survivor's remorse, was this apparent also? I mean, how did Japanese folks deal with that? Was that common?
You know, I'm not sure there's a Japanese equivalent of Deer Hunter, you know, where they're dealing with this burden of the war, you know, and, you know, it's only recently we can talk about things like PTSD, for instance, but clearly that's a theme here, you know, and it works here. And I am hard pressed to think of other Japanese movies, you know, immediately after the war. More recently, you know, Japanese filmmakers have been exploring this in a variety of ways. A movie I'll recommend is called Onoda, which is about one of the Japanese soldiers from World War II who was hiding in the Philippine jungles until the 1970s, which is really a great film. And until this moment, I would not have thought of putting it against a Godzilla movie, but it could be revealing, actually. That'd be quite a double feature.
Well, I was thinking of the movie Caterpillar. I don't know which year it came out, but it's about a veteran who survives, but who has lost all his limbs. And he comes home, but he can't do anything. And he's always angry at his wife and trying to sort of like target him as, make her the target of his anger. But he has this survivor's guilt. And then that's like coupled with his guilt of not being able to do anything because he doesn't have any limbs. And so a triple feature of depressing films. But, you know, to your question, Jason, immediately after the war, no one wanted to talk about this, right? Okay. And so the civilian survivors would talk about their guilt, which they can because they are victims themselves, right? So then Hiroshima survivors or air raid survivors who lost their family members, they would talk or start to talk a little bit about, those who would share would talk a little bit about their survivor's guilt. But, you know, just like the last years of Vietnam, the troops, when they came home, they came home to a completely different society that did not want to have anything to do with war. And even the uniforms that they were wearing, because they had nothing else, the uniforms would, for the rest of the society, become reminders of the bad wartime past that they don't want to think about anymore. And so coming back to that kind of a society, a lot of people just, you know, shut up and didn't talk about it. Mental illness trauma that was not addressed. So I was glad that this film was addressing it. Many people just, you know, became alcoholics because they just couldn't deal. And there was not like an institutional support for that kind of a need.
One of the things that kept coming out in this film, and again, I'm not a scholar of Japanese history, but so much of this, I felt like it was like I was watching a history lesson because they were talking about it so explicitly in this film, was this idea that the government had betrayed the people, that you kept hearing about over and over and over again in the film. There's this idea, information, all of these kind of things. So I was hoping maybe you guys could kind of speak to this very, which especially as the film got really going towards the end, it was like, we've got a band together. The government's not going to do it. We're going to get this right again. And maybe, you know, we call this Godzilla Minus One, referring to, I guess, the idea that after World War II, it's even less than, you know, zero. But it was like, it felt like this could have also been Godzilla, we're going to do this ourselves, you know? which I appreciate, but I was hoping maybe you guys could kind of speak to this as well. So for people who are coming to this film or coming to Japanese history, post-war Japanese history, you know, is this a recurring sentiment of the Japanese people towards the government post-war? What's that about?
Well, I mean, there was some deception, right? Because there was censorship during the war where, you know, there would be like a disaster in Saipan, for example. And then people will be reading headlines like, we have inflicted a lot of damage on the enemy.
We're doing great.
Like, complete. Yeah. And so there was that. But at the same time, when MacArthur came to occupy Japan, he wanted to create a society that was easier to rule. And so one thing he did was to sort of create bad guys, right? And so what he did was that, and he sort of sensed that there was popular support for the emperor at that time. And so he decided, okay, we are going to exonerate the emperor. And MacArthur, I am going to take credit for it so that people would like me, right? And then identify the bad people. So then the Tokyo war crimes trial take place, and then they, you know, start trying class A war criminals, and those who were indicted became the bad guys that represented the government, that represented the military. And so he was very much complicit in this creation of an environment where people felt like they were deceived by their own government. So a lot of the popular narrative is like Japanese people were like double victims, that they were victims of their own government and they were victims of the Allied air raids. Like that was the very popular narrative at that time. So this deception idea was very persistent.
So I'll just give you a personal example of this. So my father was from Japan. He was born in 1918, so he graduated college right at the start of the war, and he was in the Japanese Navy during the war. He was a commander in the Japanese Navy. He never went into combat. He worked in the chemical lab the whole war, not unlike one of the characters in this film, right? When I was growing up and he was reminiscing about those days, which was something he very seldom did. He would share how resentful he was of the Japanese government, about being betrayed by the Japanese government, and about how he had his youth stolen from him by being in the war, and that he could never forgive them for that. And that was the reason he left Japan. And why he, in later life, really his dedication was to international peace, because he felt he'd been so badly misled. I have the feeling there are a lot of Japanese who felt things like that and maybe said things like that after they had a beer or two in them, but that really wasn't part of the public discourse in post-war Japan. It really wasn't what a lot of people talked about.
I'm going to ask you for a very difficult question now. What's your critiques of this movie?
Okay, so I won't tell you my critiques to begin with, but I'll tell you what a lot of critiques I've heard from folks about this movie are. A number of people have been very disturbed that it is ahistorical in the sense that the American occupation is not present in the movie.
You know, I was wondering about that.
Mention of MacArthur and how, oh, they don't want to get involved because of the Cold War. But this idea that Godzilla can rampage through the Ginza, and at one point we do see the PX in the Ginza, so we know the Americans are there, but there are no GIs around. There are no MPs, you know, which in Japan in 1947 would have been crawling with U.S. troops at that point. You know, I have restrained myself from going onto social media and addressing this because I actually respect a lot of these commentators who've said that. But, you know, I think actually not focusing on the Americans is part of the point of this movie, right? This movie is not about Japan and the United States. It's about the tensions within the Japanese people themselves, you know? If anything, this movie's, you know, one of their main messages is the government can't solve our problems, right? We shouldn't be looking to governments for answers. We should be looking within ourselves and to other citizens around us to find our own solutions. Because as is said many times in the movie, you know, if we don't do it, who's going to, you know? And so I actually think it makes a lot of sense that the occupation and the Japanese government are essentially invisible in here.
I was thinking about the female characters, of which there were only three, right? The next door neighbor, Nobuko, and then the little girl. And
what was the little girl's name again?
Should I imitate her crying right now?
Oh, come on. When she calls him daddy the first time and he says, don't call me that. I was like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
He's got a character arc in this film. But I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Right. So he does, right? But the women do not. And we don't find out anything about, like, Nobuko. Okay, she lost her parents. So there was that little bit that came up towards the end where her parents, they were like burning with the house and told her to live. Right. So we see just a tiny bit, but we don't get a whole lot of personality of her. And it's sort of like, you know, at the very beginning, she seemed like a very feisty woman. Right. Like she's caught stealing where he saves her. Right. And, you know, she's like grumpy and all that. And then like that person just goes away immediately once she starts living with him. And she becomes this like stereotypical Japanese woman who is caring, and she's like pouring sake and she's pouring the tea and taking care of everything. And he has a nightmare. She brings him water, right? So like she had a personality at the very beginning. Like her first 5 minutes, she had a strong personality, and that just went away once she became involved with him. And it was the same with the next door neighbor woman, who was just so grumpy and you know, spiteful, right? Like, how did you even survive kind of a thing? And then she just becomes this friendly, caring next door neighbor person, and her personality too kind of disappeared into the background. And I was kind of frustrated by that.
What I think is really particularly ironic about this, right? One of the big themes of the movie is, you know, it's okay to want to live, you know, and we should want to live. And yet, when push comes to shove, Noriko is the most self-sacrificing character here because in the attack of Godzilla, she saves, you know.
She literally pushed and shoved. Yeah, you know, I actually want to ask you about this one moment. There's a moment where Noriko says, I'm taking a job. is it Ginta? Is that yep. where she's like, I'm gonna take a job, and he's like, aren't I giving you enough money? I'm like, wait, and I was like, wait, are they married? No, no, okay, they're not married. He's upset because they are clearly modeling. They are clearly in a committed relationship, whether or not they have consummated that or made it legal. They are clearly in love at this point in time. There's no doubt on either part. You know, he's denying it. She's clearly in. You're right. I thought the first time we saw her, we'd never see her again. I thought she handed the baby off like a football and she was gone. You know, and I thought Auntie was going to be like the big bad that was going to give us like drama, report on him to somebody or something. But you're absolutely right. It's like, but maybe isn't that the case? It's like, oh, wait, people do change over time. I don't know. It's like, especially Auntie kind of comes around. She's like, you know what? Maybe this is her found family after losing her kids.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
You know, but, you know, give that family gives her a reason to continue on for her to live, right? But is the job thing, was that also a thing in Japan? Where, you know, I know that in the United States, the idea is that the man is supposed to be the breadwinner, and it was only reluctantly accepted for women over time to continue to assert themselves in the workplace. I'm assuming that those were also the same kind of gender norms in Japan at this time, at least the way he's reacting to the idea of her working, is it just the fear that she's going to go to another town and leave him eventually?
I think it's another instance of like he feeling like he's lacking in masculinity if she has to go out and find a job. And I think that's why he's like, but aren't I giving you enough? And you know, in the 50s, it was typical, as was in the United States, right, for the women to stay home at least once they got married. And so, but you know, because they weren't married, is maybe she wanted to, but they aren't, which means that I guess she's also thinking about, and if we believe what she said, she wanted to earn money to become independent, right? So that she didn't have to keep living there anymore.
And to put it, of course, in historical context, 1947, when, you know, the climactic action here takes place in the film, is when Japan's new post-war constitution, largely written by the Americans, is enacted. And that constitution famously, at least in legal terms, grants equal rights to women in Japan.
What do we think about the defeating of Godzilla? Is this – I had never seen this attempt to defeat – oh, actually, I want to go back to a sec on defeating. I want to say about Godzilla himself, because we've been talking about everything other than Godzilla in this podcast, which is the entire point, I think, of this film, which makes it so great. We don't get an anthropomorphized Godzilla here. People aren't talking about Godzilla's feelings or what his agenda is. I think one of the brilliance of the thing is like Godzilla is bad and we have to kill him. I mean, there was never a second thought here. Can you kind of speak to the idea of Godzilla as just bad?
That's a big difference from the 1954 Godzilla here, I think. Godzilla 1954 movie is a really much more complicated character, because at the end of that movie, I would dare anyone not to feel some sympathy for the monster when the monster is killed by the oxygen destroyer. You know, because you realize at the end of that movie, Godzilla didn't ask to be irradiated. He's a victim too. You know, in this movie, you know, even though it's very similar at the end where you have, you know, all the Japanese on the ship saluting, you know, as Godzilla is vanquished, you don't have that same feeling. You don't have that same empathy for the monster. You are happy that the monster has been killed. And that's a big difference.
Yeah, I kept thinking, like, so why is he so angry, right? Even from the first scene, he just shows up and he just wants to destroy people. And I was kind of like, yeah, but what did these people do to you, right? And because he showed up and he was threatening, then the mechanics, they started shooting at him. But I felt like, and maybe I'm remembering it wrong, but I felt like the mechanics were responding to Godzilla's violence or attempts at violence. And so, like, yeah, that was my first thought. Like, why is he so angry?
I have a response.
Like, he didn't have a reason in the movie to be angry.
I have a response to this, and I'm hoping Bill will have a response to my response, which is we don't see Godzilla eat in this movie. He's clearly hungry. Have we ever seen he's hangry. That's why he's throwing a fit. We talked about the tuna being irradiated. They've ruined the sushi. Like, he's clearly upset. Have we ever seen Godzilla eat in a Godzilla film?
You know, in 1984, Godzilla seems to be drawing energy out of a nuclear reactor that he destroys. But it's not sort of like, you know, get a spoon and have some plutonium. And in the first movie, they are very clear about how many cows and so forth he has killed. But they never say he's actually eaten them. So we do not see Godzilla consuming anything in the films, and we do not see Godzilla scat in the films either. So his digestive capabilities are unknown.
See, these are things I hope we address in the sequel, because clearly saw the film. He's coming back hungry. Godzilla 2. Godzilla, if we do the sequel, we'll be Godzilla back to 31. Godzilla 0. I don't know. Hungry for more, and I just want to, like, maybe someone could make him a cheeseburger. I'm just saying something along those lines. Do we like the idea of how they attacked Godzilla towards the end? Is the idea of crushing him with the depths? Obviously, we know this isn't going to work because it's setting us up for the big kamikaze. We knew early on this was going to lead to a kamikaze ending. But what do you think about the our closure here of this film?
Well, you know, I will say, if we go back to the original, the 1954 movie, and that really is the natural comparison with Godzilla Minus One. You know, it is restarting the series in many ways. You know, that film was largely about science and about the triumph of Japanese science in finding a super weapon that can kill Godzilla. And that really grows directly out of the World War II experience, because if the Japanese people took one lesson away from World War II, is that our science was not as good as their science, and that's why we lost, you know? And so we need a scientific approach to the future, and the movie captured that with Serizawa designing this super weapon. So, you know, it's a science fiction movie, so Godzilla Minus One has some, you know, kooky science in it about how Godzilla's going to be killed, but it doesn't really work, right? It doesn't end up being what conquers the monster. It's that human spirit. It's that bravery at the end. It's doing his job on Shikishima's part that ends up destroying Godzilla. So it takes it a very different direction from the first time around.
Oh, that's interesting, because the Oxygen Destroyer, right, was such a novel and dangerous invention that the scientists had to, you know, die with it to, you know, to keep the secret contained. With the original one, though, I kept thinking about that part, though, because, like, if one thing that we learned from World War II, we need to value our lives and not, like, self-sacrifice for whatever means. And, yeah, you know, the first time I watched the original, I was shocked when I found out at the end that the scientist was going into the ocean with the Oxygen Destroyer. Because that's like his ultimate sacrifice, right? Yeah. He is the one who came up with this technology. And then I do understand the critique of technology, right? Because of what happened at the end of World War II. And therefore, technology can be dangerous. And I get that logic. I was there till that point. And then when he was like, and then I'm going to go in with it, I was like, no, but didn't you learn anything from the Japanese experience of World War II?
I want to ask you, and this might be the elephant in the room, when we talk about this film, there's other films right now dealing with World War II. We've talked about partnering this film with other films, but I think we have to talk about this movie in conversation with Oppenheimer. And the United States is grappling with the horrors of World War II in inflicting this calamity, this awful, awful devastation onto Japan. How do these films – is it possible to talk about these movies in context with one another here in 2023 at all? I mean, what does this say that both the United States and Japan are putting out movies that are directly addressing the atomic bombs some 80 years later? Why now?
You know, it's interesting because, you know, another one of the critiques of the film I've heard is that one of the continuities between this film and the original 1954 Godzilla is that the Japanese are portrayed as victims yet again. And it doesn't really look at the way in which the Japanese had victimized others during the war and in the road to war. And that's very much true, you know. And while this definitely does deal with the costs of war, it is really just the cost of the war for the Japanese people, you know. Mm-hmm. And that way, I think, is different from Oppenheimer, you know. It's different from the 1954 movie, too, right, which does shift a lot of the blame to the United States and to the Cold War situation. Here, I think the nuclear angle is, you know, it's pretty passive, honestly. You know, this is a pacifist movie, but the pacifism is not about nuclear weapons. It's more about the human costs of war rather than, you know, this potential destruction of our planet. And so I would say, you know, it actually is very different than Oppenheimer in how it takes on this historical moment.
Yeah, you're right in that Godzilla Minus One, the main critique of those men went to the government and the system, where I remember when the Navy vets are gathered in the hall, right, where the scientist is like revealing his new invention. And then the Navy former admiral, was it? The guy who takes charge of the boat. And he's like, I'm not ordering you. You can leave if you'd like. And during that sequence, there was so much of, these are the ways that we are doing things differently from before. And we're not like, we are not cheapening your lives, right? We are doing this not to die, but for the future, or something like that. I'm paraphrasing. And that's a huge critique of, you know, the ways that the military leaders treated people's lives as expendable, especially the foot soldiers, people who were actually fighting. And there was a saying back then in the 40s where, you know, the troops would be saying to each other, like, our lives are only worth as much as how much it costs to send a draft notice. In other words, my life doesn't really matter because those guys back in Tokyo, they can just send a draft notice to get another person to just replace me, right? So I don't matter. My life doesn't matter. And that became a huge critique. Or, you know, they weren't openly talking about it back then, but there were chatter in the military. And so I think that there was a sense, and I mean, the kamikaze pilots, right? That's a very good example of how, like, the human life doesn't really matter as long as it maybe benefits the bigger cause, right? And so there was a huge critique of that in that segment. But I'm not talking about Oppenheimer. you know, but like the Oppenheimer also got a critique, right? Where we don't see the explosion, right? We see the test explosion, but we don't, and we see Oppenheimer watching a videotape or something of the bomb explode over Hiroshima. And we just watch, and I think the director said that, you know, he wanted to focus on Oppenheimer's reaction rather than, and I'm kind of like, yeah, but if it's a film, couldn't you do both? So, and so there was a critique of that. So, you know, it's really difficult to write a straightforward story that takes in a lot of complex, like does justice to complexity of historical reality.
Yeah, you know, I always kind of feel like this is the same way when I'm like reviewing a book. And I remember, and I was telling this story the other day about when I was in grad school. And you know, you sit around the table, and of course, as graduate students, everyone's sitting around taking their turn to in their seminar to read the book and give their hot take on the, and why isn't this in the book? And I would have put this. And ultimately, one of these just always drove me nuts was just like, it's like, just what's directly in front of you? Let's just talk about that. And I think that, yeah, you know, it kind of speaks to the reason why you don't have to have Americans say in this film. So the movie isn't about Americans. And frankly, it's, you know, it's about this, it's about Japanese people and to a, and then to a very specific group of a very, very, you know, few folks who I love the casting in this. I didn't know the actors at all. Yeah. Wasn't familiar with anybody in this movie. So for me, I was coming in this completely foreign, and I loved loved the acting in this film. I just did. I want to ask you, as we're kind of coming to a close to here now, we've got this film that just came out. There's another Godzilla film coming out in like 9 hours is what it feels like. The Godzilla X Kong Godzilla. I don't know what it's called. And then there's the whole Apple series, the Monarch series. Is it? That's also Godzilla-y? Is that a word? we're going to go with it. It's going to be a great time to be a Godzilla fan, is it right? Bill, like,
never been a better time to be a Godzilla fan. Yeah, no. I remember 2014 when the first Legendary MonsterVerse Godzilla film opened. I watched it in one of those giant suburban multiplexes in Dallas with about 250 other people. By the end of the movie, everyone in that darn room, including my wife, who hates Godzilla, were up on their feet screaming, you know, at the monster. And I'm like, this is the ultimate. Right? You know, we've reached this point where everybody on this planet, I think, knows who Godzilla is. And plenty of the people on this planet are willing to put out $15 to go watch that monster on the big screen. So not only are we having movies coming out from both Japan and the United States, which are very, very different, but also there's more Godzilla merchandise than most of us fans know what to do with. You know, my office is already filled with Godzilla toys. I have the feeling in the next couple of years, I'm going to need a second office.
Is it not cool seeing like these different countries doing different takes on the same character and these ideas? I think it's fascinating to see this movie in comparison to these other things. It's got to be so cool.
I got to be honest, it makes me sort of ashamed to be an American that, you know, how much did the most recent Godzilla movie cost? Godzilla versus Kong, you know, something like $200 million. Godzilla Minus One was a $15 million budget, you know. Wow, you know, the amount of creativity that went into Minus One puts the most recent Hollywood offerings to shame, unfortunately.
Yeah. Do you think there'll be a sequel?
I sincerely hope so. So Yamazaki said he would like to make one. I think it'd be fun to give him another shot at it because he did a wonderful job. You know, what Toho's success has been in the last two Godzilla movies, 2016 Shin Godzilla and now Godzilla Minus One, is they hired really strong directors to make the movies. People who had established records before they got Godzilla. So not just another hack who happened to be a Godzilla fan, which was often the case in the past, but they got people with independent directorial visions, and they've done a wonderful job with it. So if it's Yamazaki, if it's not Yamazaki, I hope it's someone who is equally talented who takes on the monster next.
Because I keep thinking about the final scene. Right.
Oh, her, he's coming back.
Neck.
Yeah. Oh. What's the deal with that?
Right? That. Oh, right.
Yeah.
What was up with that? That was scary.
At the very end.
What was up with that? I had never thought that. Like, it's like, oh, they're happy together, and now she's got this weird.
And it was growing.
Yeah. Black. And that's usually not a good sign. I'm not a scientist, but you know. Generally, the veins should not go black, I don't think, you know. You know, Yamazaki's been very cagey, very smart. He's like, you know, I've always wanted to direct a Star Wars film. And after watching that, I'm like, give the man $15 million. I do not want to give him $200 million. Let's see where he can go as well. All right, I got two final questions for you here, which is this. Where does this movie rank? Where I hate to do this to you, especially Bill, but like, where does this Godzilla go in the pantheon of Godzilla films? As far as is this an upper tier film? Is this where is this in terms of like quality, best? What do you think?
I would say no question to me. This is, you know, in the top handful of Godzilla films. For me, the 1954, that original movie, because of its sheer visceral power, because of its innovative nature and creativity, and the way it has stood the test of time over the decades. In fact, I think we just appreciate it more with each passing decade. That's the classic. That is the standard. And as good as this one is, it can't approach that. But I think in the sense of a movie that gets us thinking, and will have staying power because it raises so many issues. Godzilla Minus One is going to be up there.
And in my case, like I can only say this is number two because I've only seen two, right?
So you're saying it's like in the top Bill two. Said,
well, because I've only seen two. But I really, though, did appreciate how they really depicted the immediate post-war Japanese condition, right? And because I don't think that kind of scene really circulates in, you know, outside of Japan, and how life struggles continue on into the late 40s. That's something that I was glad to see in a film that became so popular,
you know,
outside of Japan.
Americans, by and large, know about the bombs when it talks. And maybe they know about the island hopping campaign. And they've heard of Guadalcanal. And they've heard of some other places. And they know about Iwo Jima. For whatever reason, Americans don't know about firebombing campaigns in Japan, you know, in Japan. And it's horrific and violent and brutal. And as we see, people are recovering from that when we see them in Tokyo, you know. And to see the remnants of that, people are talking about, it's like, oh, after that was over, you still have to put your life back together. And then there's a monster, you know. Also, you've got PTSD and you can't figure out how to tell your woman, that, you know, this woman that you love her. So... there's a lot going on in 1947.
But right, so like I really appreciated how it depicted not just the physical damage, but also the psychological, emotional damage. And loss of family and families being separated. And so like I really appreciated that being on a film depicted pretty well on a film that is very popular outside of Japan.
All right. Well, let me ask you our final question here, the one we build everything to on these podcasts. Is Godzilla Minus One a history movie?
You know, I don't know what a history movie is, but, you know, I think some might dismiss it as a period piece set in a period that most people don't care to remember, frankly. But, you know, if you're looking for historical accuracy in here, our conversation about the occupation earlier suggests, okay, it's not, you know, terribly accurate in terms of its depiction of what Japan as a whole was like at that time. And yet, I think to take you through time into a place and into the minds of people very, very far away in experience, it does a remarkably good job.
Yeah, I too do not know what a history film is. And yeah, just like Bill said, so it's not so much about the accuracy, but it's capturing the essence of the time, right? It's capturing human experiences, human emotions at the time. And so like for that to be captured, maybe there can be some historical inaccuracy. I mean, I wish there weren't, but at the same time, right? Sometimes it has to be that way for dramatic reasons, like not really showing a whole lot of occupation forces. But I think it did a very good job capturing, you know, what people were going through at the time.
Awesome. Guys, I can't thank you enough for being here, for being part of this podcast. I was so excited to talk to you guys about this movie, to get a chance to go. I literally ran off to go see it last night just so we could do this. I was so tired when I got home. And my entire day was really built around getting here to sit down to talk to you. And we're going to turn this podcast around as fast as we possibly can. Where can people find you guys if they want to learn more about the work that you're doing, learn more about Godzilla, learn more about Japanese history? Where can people find you, either online, the Twitterverse, wherever? Where did I find you? So
you can go to BillSutsui.com and not only link to some of my academic work, but also a music video of me related to Godzilla.
Seen it.
Ooh.
I saw
Very
it.
Very nice. I should create a website. I don't. If you Google my name, my, you know, website at the University of Kentucky will show up. I am still on Twitter. I'm at ATA225. I think I have the same handle on Blue Sky and Mastodon. I am not on Threads yet.
Awesome. Guys, thank you so, so very much. I can't thank you enough for being here tonight. And this is late. It's for if you take the time. It means the world to me and also to the people who are listening to this pod. People are excited about this film. So thank you so, so very much.
This was really fun, Jason. Thank you.
I had a lot of fun too. Thank you so much.
And that's a wrap here at Historians of the Movies podcast. Thank you so very much to our guests, Bill Satsui and Akiko Takenaka today. Thank you so much for being here, for being part of this conversation today. We just put this thing together. We had never met before a couple days ago, and I just felt like talking to you. I'd known you for so freaking long, and I am so happy that I've made your friendship today through this thing we call the HATM. That was amazing. We also have to thank Fletcher Powell, our producer, for putting this together. I said, Fletch, can we please do another emergency pod? It takes a lot for Fletcher to put these pods together, so I am really thankful to him for agreeing to do this late on a Saturday night. Thank you so much, Fletcher, for putting this together. And of course, thank you guys for giving us a reason to put this thing together, for your enthusiasm. If we were just doing one of these each single week, it would be fine. But you guys are really latching on to these emergency pods. There's a real enthusiasm for Godzilla Minus One, and it feels like an enthusiasm for this podcast as well. So it means the world to me. We're putting this together for you late on a Saturday night because you guys have asked for it, and we want to give to you what you want. So thank you so much for being here. Thanks for continuing to share this podcast, for telling to tell other people about this. And thanks most importantly for being part of this HATM community. And if you're listening to this, you know that every Sunday night we live stream a live watch of film as well. So on Sunday night, on December 10th, Sunday night at 8 p.m., you can also jump in with us. There's a movie on Netflix. It's called Minari. We're going to be live. We're going to be live tweeting that as well. We're going to watch party on that. So sit back and watch that as well with us. We'd love to have you in. It's going to be on Netflix, 8 p.m. Eastern. And that's all for now. So thanks for being here. And that was an awesome talk. So ciao for now.